Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's January the 13th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom is the rising of the moon.
Okay, in this podcast, I'll be getting to a lot of the emails that have been piling up over this past month. First off, this one comes from a guy who doesn't want me to give his name out on the air. Okay, fine. Dear Mr. Covington, I listened to one of your broadcasts about who is white, and I know what you mean by nationality doesn't determine race, and I agree. This first question will be quick and is a yes or no question. All right, anyway, this goes on, and I won't read the whole email itself for reasons I think you'll see in a bit. Anyway, the guy just kind of rambles on and on about Southern Italians and Greeks, and are they really white? He doesn't say which side of the issue or non-issue he's on, and he concludes, "By the way, I purchased one of your Northwest novels, and it's on the way, A Distant Thunder. If you choose to answer this one on the radio podcasts, please don't mention my name or even my first name. Thank you." Like virtually every question I get these days, I've addressed this before, on several occasions, but I know that most of you haven't had the time to download and listen to all 50 previous Radio Free Northwest podcasts. Now, it's been some months since I've gone over this, and even those of you who did listen to my previous casts have probably forgotten, given the short American attention span, which I am well aware, by the way, is not your fault. It's just the way the Jews have engineered you. Americans need regular spaced repetition in order to internalize ideas, so I'm quite willing to go over this again. I'm going to be honest with you. Anytime I hear anyone bring up this crap about Italians or the whole who is white question, I immediately think troll. Somebody is trying to stir, because this is one of those issues that generates heat rather than light, and which bears virtually no connection to anything that we actually face in the real world. So let me give you guys the wrap real quick. First off, as a general guideline, 19th century racial science with nose and cranium measurements about Baltics and Alpines and Nordics and Mediterraneans is completely irrelevant to a race facing physical extinction here in the 21st century, a race whose women and children are being raped and butchered like that poor girl at Notre Dame last week, and whose white population is about to become a minority, and an aging minority at that in North America. Given the terrible and unspeakable day-to-day realities with which we must live, this issue of whether anybody whose name ends in a vowel is white is about 427th on what should be our list of priorities. In fact, it is so irrelevant that I really get suspicious when somebody brings it up and will not let it go, as you will find often happens. It's always a red flag when someone continually tries to intrude these little nitpicky teapot tempests that generate heat rather than light into a racial crisis that's growing worse every day. Now, when that happens, somebody is trying to stir. This is one of those years of experience things that I hope I can convey to you guys, because one day you're going to have to be doing all this by yourselves. And so you need to watch out for people, especially anonymous people on the internet, who won't let you get a look at them and what their true agenda might be. People who are clearly trying to intrude themselves into your operation with the intent to stir. Always remember, with the internet, you never really know who you're talking to or who is signing their checks. Now, that having been said, I have two standard answers to the who is white thing. Number one is that we all know damn well who and what white is when we see it. Apply the 60-second test. There is such a thing as instinctive recognition. If there's any doubt within the first 60 seconds after you meet someone, your first instinct is probably correct, and although the person in question may be perfectly sincere, if they have the slightest visible touch of the tar brush, then they need to be eased away from the group, especially because their presence will raise more questions and cause more problems than the probable value of their contribution. Now, if you can detect even the slightest touch of the tar brush, send them over to the Tea Party or to VNN, where it doesn't matter. Jewish racial recognition is a topic I don't want to get into here because it's one of those things I really can't do well without audiovisual aids. I need to show you examples, not just tell you. Just because somebody has a big nose or olive skin does not automatically mean they're a Jew or a mestizo. Have you never heard of the Roman nose that you can see on busts of Julius Caesar and the philosopher Seneca and so on? Sephardic Jews, or Mizrahi as they're called in Israel, are racially indistinguishable from Arabs. Sephardim really are Semites, whereas your basic Brooklyn-type Ashkenazi are Khazars, an Armenioid people. Now, Ashkenazi Jews have certain very specific racial markers that someone can spot with experience. You need to look not only at size, but at shape, at the configuration of the proboscis. Good rule of thumb is that in profile it resembles the numeral 6, with a downturned, fleshy tip and flared nostrils. But I'd have to show you, and of course a good plastic surgeon makes his living off giving Jews nose jobs. I understand Jewish parents routinely give nose jobs to their daughters as high school graduation presents. Now you need to look at ears. You need to look at skull shape. You need to look at lips. You need to look at the configuration of hands and the length of arms and legs and their proportion. With women, you need to check out the bust for certain telltale signs, which I won't get into without, you know, getting too sleazy here. But with both sexes, it's the overall face, which in an Ashkenazi tends to look more and more like a camel as the individual ages. Basically, spotting a kike from physiognomy is an art that can only be acquired with long study and experience. Although, oddly enough, this is one advantage where people from New York have it all over us. A New Yorker can spot a Hebe right off the bat from long familiarity. However, I do have to say that even us so-called experts can be fooled on occasion. I remember there are such things as naturally blonde and red-headed Jews. Look at Molly Ringwald. The Jews claim that a blonde Jew is someone whose grandmother was raped by Cossacks, and let's tell it straight, yeah, that happened. As much as I hate to sound like a liberal, there is something to their contention that by the early 21st century, virtually every race on Earth has suffered at least some genetic adulteration by now, which is another reason why 19th century racial science is no longer applicable, especially in North America, where there have been generations of intermarriage between different nations of white peoples. Irish people marrying Poles, Germans marrying Czechs, Italians marrying Anglo-Saxons, so forth and so on. But I'm moving off the track here. Getting back to the question, in old apartheid South Africa, there were basically three criteria for establishing race on a legal basis. Most of the borderline cases were between whites and what's called Cape Coloreds. Now, the first was obvious. Does an individual claim to be white? Secondly, can they show quote-unquote acceptance under community standards, which is where the gray area set in? In other words, can they show a documented white family tree, and can they show that their family has always been accepted as white by their local community? And finally, there was the evidence of the eyeballs, although I can't remember exactly how this was phrased precisely under the old race laws, but there was a long legal definition which said basically, peekaboo, I see you, and the upshot of which was that if you look like a nigger, you're a nigger. Now, this, I think, was to prevent actual Bantu from claiming to be white. Now, if you passed all three of those tests, you got your Blank Burger card, Blank Burger, which means white citizen in Afrikaans. I'm not going to waste any more time on this. People, it's a matter of common sense, and true borderline cases are very, very rare. Like I said before, people who try to inject this question into a group are usually trying to stir for whatever motive. It's one of those things that can be discussed in abstract theoretical concept, but most people don't have the mental detachment or the necessary education or sophistication to do so. Genuine prejudice starts setting in, and all of a sudden you're generating heat and not light, so it's best to leave it alone and stick to good old-fashioned common sense. Works every time. Next email. Dear HAC, I've heard you say that you use the stick because you have no carrot to use to get people to come home, but I disagree. I've visited the Northwest states, and the geography and climate are definitely carrots that can be used. Also, after having read some of Hill of the Ravens, a description of the wonderful culture and society we can expect when we are being expected to tolerate the black, Latino, Jew, and sexually sick cultures currently thrust on us from the media would sound like somebody telling us of a white paradise. Just a thought, Steve from Michigan. Well, you're right, Steve. When I'm sending out my intro packets, whenever possible, I try to include some full-color touristy stuff that's got some good pictures of the Northwest in it. I generally urge people to make their scouting trip in the spring or summer or early autumn when they can have at least some chance of catching some good weather. There's a saying out here that every Northwest winter is the same, but every Northwest summer is different. As to the vision of the future, that's what the purpose of novel number 5 is. If I can never allocate enough time actually to write it. I started on October 22nd, and I've so far gotten about 35,000 words done, which is the first three chapters. I discussed the exact situation regarding that in my status report for the year 2010. Anyway, next email. This is from Jay in Alaska. Dear HAC, I'll be graduating high school soon, so I was wondering what things I should major in to help the white community best with good pay. Thanks, Jay in Alaska. Okay, I think you've hit the nail on the head, Jay. You need something to do that is both useful and which makes money. I don't know exactly what your personal and your family situation is, and for all I know, you may have middle-class parents who fully expect to spend $100,000 putting you through 4 years of college to get a completely useless degree in English or multicultural studies or some pointless piece of academic paper like that. Nor do you tell me what your aptitudes are and what you like to do, and so I'm a little handicapped here, but essentially what I recommend is that young white men, and to a lesser extent young white women, find themselves a marketable skill in the form of something they can do with their hands. You don't want to aim for being a cubicle dweller all your life because those jobs are going to disappear when the balloon finally does go up. And in any case, the cubicle world in both the private and the public sectors is riddled with political correctness and affirmative action, and they have been for a generation. Now, back in the day, when I was living in Raleigh, I spent a grand total of almost 7 years working on and off for First Union Bank and First Union Mortgage Corporation. It was probably accumulation of a good 3 years or so, always as a temp, once for almost a year as a temp. And it was made clear to me that I would never be hired on permanently because of my race and my gender. I saw women of all colors coming in from the same temp agency I'd be working for, and 6 weeks later, they were hired on permanently with full benefits, while every Friday, I still had to go find some little girl young enough to be my daughter and have her sign my ticket so I could get my weekly minimum wage check from the temp agency with no benefits at all, of course. The realities of life can mess with a white man's head, and I know that a lot of you out there have undergone this same experience in many forms or another. Basically, Jay, you need to learn to fix the rich man's toys when they break. Learn to fix their luxury cars and their boats. Learn to fix their air conditioners and 60-inch plasma TVs and their cell phones or whatever the current fad toy for the super rich is. There will always be both Jewish and Gentile super rich, at least until we really can stage a revolution and kill them all. But you can't count on that intervening in your life anytime soon, at least not soon enough to make a practical difference. The wealthy will always have some kind of toy that breaks on a regular basis, and it may not be convenient or practical simply to drive to Walmart or Nordstrom's of the Bond and buy a new one. You need to be the guy that they call to fix it, Jay. You need to provide a good service, fast and cheaper than anybody else. When you can do that, you will always work. Because if you can do something better and faster and cheaper than someone else, the rich man isn't going to care about your politics or your race or your past. All he cares about is value for his money. If you like computers, fine, but learn to repair and design hardware, not software. Every computer geek teenager thinks that someday he's going to be able to make a living sitting in an air-conditioned cubicle and playing with a computer. Or he's going to do an internet startup in his garage or whatever, but this isn't the 90s anymore, and that ship has sailed. Internet and IT have been taken over long since by big business combines like Google and Yahoo and eBay and Facebook and whatnot. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. Internet is now part of the problem and less part of the solution. IT grads are now being turned out like lollipops by every community college and by the ripoff schools you see on TV, and they're as common as dirt. With most IT degrees and a dollar, you can buy a cup of watery coffee at McDonald's. Now, if I could go back over my own high school, I would have made sure to include at least two or three auto shop classes. You need to know these things just in order to keep your own car functioning. I'll tell you another profession you young guys might want to consider, although it's murderously hard work, and that's becoming an actual chef as opposed to a burger flipper in Mickey D's. Now, if you can become a cordon bleu chef, you can pull down a six-figure salary and live in Europe in resort communities all around the world, although a white nationalist probably won't want to end up living in Jamaica or Florida or Hawaii. I lived in Hawaii for a while, and let me tell you, the weather's nice all right, but it gets boring as hell, and the racial situation there's deteriorating. Engineering and pure science for young whites are kind of a mixed bag. It's definitely a field that attracts a lot of young white people, given our natural love of science and gadgets and finding out answers to difficult questions, but these fields are now becoming badly clogged with political correctness and diversity, especially engineering, where white engineers with the degrees and the experience that should get them $100,000 per year are being replaced and phased out by macacas from India and Uzbekistan and other weird places in Asia who work for $30,000 a year and live together jammed five and six into a two-bedroom apartment like so many Mexican braceros. Basically, the way it works in practice is that Mexicans are being brought into this country as manual labor to replace the blacks, who no longer want to work at all, and the Asians and Hindus are being brought in to replace skilled white labor, which has become too expensive and too much trouble because white engineers won't put up with the kind of crap from management that the macacas will for fear of losing their immigration status. Science is in some respects even worse. Both pure science and applied science are now crushed under a ton of politically correct gibberish. Since the Democrats gave up on the space program and started phasing out NASA, most pure and applied science is now in the private sector, which mostly means big farm. And most scientific research these days has to do with pharmaceuticals and various things which in the final analysis concern creaming off the life savings of the baby boom generation in order to keep them alive and keep them young for a few more years, or at least younger looking. Now, you see all these ads on TV to the effect about ask your doctor about Bugger X that'll cleanse your colon squeaky clean, or cock-a-doodle-doo, the little blue pill for erectile dysfunction, that kind of stuff. Basically, the baby boomers are convinced that they're going to live forever, and they just plain refuse to get old. And since they now have most of the wealth that still exists in private hands in this country in one form or another, parting them from that wealth in various ways has now become probably the major industry in America, since we don't manufacture anything anymore. Anyway, I'm starting to ramble off on a tangent, Jay, so send me some more details about your personal skills and your aptitudes and your interests, and I'll be able to give you a more detailed response and some hopefully better career advice. First music break. How about a really depressing old-time country song? Here's the Cox Family from the O Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack.
Kiss me. Thank you. kiss me, mother, kiss your darling. See the pain upon my brow, while I'll soon be with the angels. Fate has
Next email comes from Sharon in Texas. Dear Mr. Covington, do you think the Obama regime is going to stage another big terror attack like 9/11 in order to shore up their sagging popularity ratings and pass more unconstitutional laws? Yes, Sharon, I think it's entirely possible. Now, you may remember that over the Christmas holidays, the media were gibbering about an imminent al-Qaeda attack on America, and they were even pinning it down to Christmas Day itself. We were all waiting for something to go boom on Christmas Day, and then nothing happened. Now, has anyone besides me noticed that ever since 9/11, there has not been a major successful attack on American soil, except for a couple that were clearly done by nutty individuals acting alone, like that Muslim doctor who went apeshit with a gun at Fort Hood, or that kid that put a truck bomb in Times Square who's supposed to have quote-unquote trained with the Taliban, and yet who couldn't even wire a detonator to his truck bomb that worked? Of course, it turned out later that whole thing was set up by the FBI from beginning to end. Guys, I got some basic explosives training in the Army, and it's not that hard to make a detonator that works. That poor dumb kid was set up by the FBI, and they even pretty much admitted it in the media reports. Oh, sure, every 6 months or so, we get all these arrests for supposed conspiracy on the part of some poor little Apu down at the Quickie Mart, where some agent provocateur hired by the FBI plants some household chemicals in the guy's garage and claims it's bomb-making material. But one of the dead giveaways on an FBI terror hoax is that the so-called terrorists are always arrested without incident and without one single American bureaucrat or Jew or secret policeman or rich man getting so much as a nick on his little finger. The American political and financial elite have spilled more blood in the sink shaving than has ever been spilled by white Americans who are actually resisting them. I wouldn't put it at all past the Democrats to stage a 9/11-style terrorist attack like the Republicans did in 2001 and like the Clinton Democrats did in Oklahoma City in 1995. Americans have a bad habit of automatically snapping to attention whenever something like that happens and doing whatever the current idiot in the White House tells them to do, and that includes giving up whatever's left of their constitutional rights so the big bad Arabs under their bed won't get them. I just hope that if and when the government does decide to stage another 9/11, they decide to blame this big terror attack on the Muslims and frame Apu down from the Quickie Mart for it instead of us. All right, next email is from some soppy liberal girl in Massachusetts, where else? And I won't give her name because she's an idiot, and I'm one of those old dinosaurs who thinks it's impolite to call a lady a fool in public, even when she is. Nor will I read her email aloud. because it's just Jew liberal gibberish, and I don't read liberal gibberish out loud on here. The way I look at it, the lefty libs and the kikes have got CNN and MSNBC and the Huffington Puffington Post and all the rest of the internet to spew their crap all over. Not here. Liberal idiots are not allowed to babble their bullshit on here. It's just nice to think that there are still a few places like that. But the gist of this email is as follows. Dear Mr. Covington, you are horrible and wicked and cruel because you deny the Holocaust and the terrible suffering of the Jewish people, and you insult the memory of the Jewish people who suffered at the hands of Hitler, blah, 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 ishkabibble. You are a big meanie. Yeah, I am. Okay, let's take another run at the Holo hoax. I'm just going to lay a few interesting bullet points on you guys here off the top of my head. One of the founders of Holocaust revisionism was not a wicked, evil Nazi, as you might think. He was a communist named Paul Racinier, or Racinier, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce that, who was born in 1906, and he was actually imprisoned in a concentration camp by the Nazis because he was a member of the French Resistance, and among his other activities was shipping Jews out of France into Switzerland. He was arrested in 1943, and he was sent to the Buchenwald concentration camp. I've always found it very amusing that the father of Holocaust revisionism is an actual concentration camp survivor, and his motive was the simple one of truth for its own sake. After the war, Paul Racinier, whatever how you pronounce that, noticed that all the propaganda claims about gas chambers and atrocities committed against the Jews in the same camp where he'd been interned contradicted his experience in that camp. In other words, the Jews were saying things about Buchenwald that just plain were not true and did not happen. And of course, the Germans were in no position to defend themselves. Now, Racinier started speaking up saying, hey folks, these Hebrews are lying. And having made this assertion regarding his own camp, he then proceeded to research the question of all the claimed atrocities committed against the Jews and the concentration camps in general. And between 1950 and 1964, he wrote a series of books on the subject. In 1950, Paul Racinier questioned the reality of the Holocaust period. And as time progressed, his doubts that the Holocaust was real grew stronger, until he denied it completely in 1962, when he called it a historic lie, the most tragic and most macabre imposture of all time. Now bear in mind, this doesn't come from a so-called anti-Semite. It comes from a communist who actually helped Jews escape during the war, and in view of the fact that the Nazis locked him up in a concentration camp for 2 years, it'd be kind of hard to accuse him of being pro-Nazi. I'll tell you another dead giveaway. In the official report of the International Red Cross on the Second World War, there was no mention made of any so-called extermination camps. During the war, the Red Cross was allowed regular access to places like Auschwitz and Dachau, and they never reported any gas chambers or any extermination plots or anything like that. There's a couple of points you need to bear in mind. The famous films, those grainy black and white things that were constantly being shown on television of all the horrible scenes that the Allied troops discovered when they liberated these camps in German soil, are not proof of any Holocaust as they purport to be. A total breakdown of Germany's infrastructure during the last months of the war caused starvation and outbreaks of disease in these camps. Now, that's what these films depict. Starvation and disease, true, and nobody denies that, but not genocide, as is insinuated on television and in the movies. Now, you want to know where that figure, 6 million allegedly murdered Jews, comes from? It comes from one document, the alleged confession of Rudolf Huss, the former commandant of Auschwitz, who was captured and executed by the Russians. Huss signed that confession in English, a language that he could not read, and the original document is splattered with brown stains of blood where Huss was beaten by his interrogators. Auschwitz was the site of Germany's newest and most technologically advanced synthetic rubber plant, and Germany was the world's leader in this particular field of technology at the time. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese cut off America's supply of natural rubber. In the months that followed, the Americans set about building their own synthetic rubber plants. This was an area where we had no experience. It stands to reason that efforts would have been made to obtain aerial photographs of the synthetic rubber plant in Auschwitz, which was the most modern of such plants in existence at the time. That was during the summer of 1942, when Congress authorized the construction of such plants here in this country. which was after the mass murder of Jews had allegedly begun in Auschwitz and thousands of Jews were allegedly being killed every day. Now, it's probable that such aerial surveillance was carried out, and yet no aerial photographs of Auschwitz were ever offered as evidence at Nuremberg, and the whole subject is very, very secret. Wonder why? Not so much because of what those aerial photographs might show, but because of what they don't show. Now, furthermore, let's think about this. Is it credible that the Germans were conducting their largest mass murder operation at a site that they must have known America would be going to great lengths to photograph from the air? Now, we need to draw a distinction between hard and soft evidence. We got a lot of weepy, whiny, so-called survivor testimony from Jews, who, by the way, have a financial interest in the Holocaust because they've gotten billions of dollars in compensation for this supposed historical event. But what we don't have is confirming hard evidence, such as aerial photographs, contemporary German documents, German confessions that were not extracted by the Stalinist Russians under torture, and were even pretty short on the testimony of non-Jewish camp inmates, which, by the way, you might also bear in mind that the majority of the inmates in all of the camps weren't Jews at all. The overwhelming bulk of evidence for the Holocaust consists of soft evidence, so-called. Isn't it doubtful that an operation on that kind of massive scale like the Holocaust would leave no hard evidence at all? Now, the Germans didn't have DDT, their general purpose pesticide, which was used, whether the pests were rats or lice or whatever, was a commercial product called Zyklon B. Its active ingredient was hydrogen cyanide. Zyklon B consisted of solid disks that would give off hydrogen cyanide gas when exposed to air. Large amounts of Zyklon B were found in the Nazi camps, but there is a non-criminal explanation for this that's well documented. In the camps, there were outbreaks of typhus fever, which was carried by lice. Now, Zyklon B was the agent supposedly used to kill Jews en masse in the alleged gas chambers. However, since 1988, the forensic evidence has existed that refutes this claim. Hydrogen cyanide combines with iron found in bricks and mortar to form a stable iron cyanide compound that can be detected years later. Now, in 1988, the American chemical engineer Fred Leuchter took samples from the inner walls and floors of the alleged gas chambers in Auschwitz, and he compared them with samples taken from the inner walls and floor of what was known to be a delousing chamber in Auschwitz, a delousing chamber that was used to disinfect clothing. Enormous differences in the amounts of iron cyanide compound were found in the samples taken from the alleged gas chambers and those taken from the delousing chamber. Leuchter's findings have been confirmed by subsequent forensic analyses, including one that was commissioned by the Auschwitz State Museum. Revisionist literature pretty much proves that the Holocaust was a hoax from the very beginning. I think a sizable percentage of educated Americans would draw the same conclusion if they were familiar with the revisionist arguments and if they were ever allowed to hear the facts presented. This is one reason for all the laws in Europe sending anyone who questions the Holocaust to prison, because the fact is that the Holocaust can't stand up to rational analysis or debate. Why does the truth need laws and prison to defend it? How has this situation come about where millions of people believe in a historical event that didn't happen? Simple. The Jews possessed nearly absolute control of the media of communications, and they've manipulated that control for the purpose of extorting billions of dollars in so-called reparations from Germany and the rest of the world, and more importantly, to establish a kind of moral superiority over the rest of us, which gives the bandit state of Israel the unlimited ability to do whatever the hell it wants to do, including start a war with Iran that will cut off the bulk of the world's petroleum supply and destroy the world's economy in order to save their own asses. Okay, after all that dry historical crap that most people probably aren't really interested in, and most of you probably found very boring, we need something to wake you guys up and pep up your interest. This is the Pipes and Drums of the Royal Scots Guards. Okay, we interrupt this pointless babble for a breaking news bulletin. Something's come up. The first thing I need to explain is that I'm actually making this Radio Free Northwest on the morning of Sunday, January the 9th, which is early. I usually do most of the vocal on Tuesdays, but this week I need to have this episode in the can by tonight so I can upload it before the scheduled date and time on Thursday. Now, the reason I'm doing it so early is that tomorrow we have some incoming Northwest migrants arriving here in our primary settlement area, and because you folks, in your wisdom, have decided that we don't need a general headquarters unit or a national organizer, I myself, as well as some comrades who live in the area, have allocated at least part of Monday through Thursday to talk with them, show them around the area, so forth and so on. Now, wouldn't you know it, this is, of course, the very weekend that something has come up which I need to comment on, and since I'm making this podcast so early, I have to do so before all the facts are in, and by the time you actually hear the podcast, this whole commentary may be inoperative in some way. I'm referring, of course, to the shooting of a Jew congresswoman, her Jewish aide, and a federal judge in a Safeway in Arizona by a young white man whose name is apparently Jared Loughner, along with a number of other people, race unknown, and the race of the other victims is in fact highly relevant in determining whether or not this young man was racially and politically motivated. So far, all the attention is on the two Jews and the judge, and we haven't been allowed to learn this information by the media as to exactly who else was shot and what color they were. But again, this is early days, and by the time the podcast is uploaded, new information may have come out that invalidates everything I say here. Now, that's just the risk I have to take. Now, in view of the contents of one section of my Radio Free Northwest broadcast for January the 6th, that's last week, there is some possibility that the regime may try somehow to cast the blame for this attack against the Democratic establishment on your friend and humble narrator, meaning me. I don't think so. I think they're after bigger game, and they'll try to hang this with equal inaccuracy on the Tea Party and then Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck. The latest news is that Obama's secret police are apparently trying to pin this on Jared Taylor, an American Renaissance of all people, calling him anti-Semitic. Oh, for crying out loud! If that's an example of the FBI and the SPLC's so-called intelligence-gathering skills, then we're in a lot better shape than I thought. Now, anyone who described American Renaissance as anti-Jewish clearly doesn't know their ass from a hole in the ground. Jared Taylor has rabbis to speak at his conferences. He's got some kind of tame neocon rabbi on his staff. And according to persistent movement rumor, he's supposedly married to a Jew, although, by the way, I have never seen any actual documentation on that last bit. That's just one of these things that flies all over the internet, and no one actually seems to have any details on it. By the way, I was also supposed to be married to a Jew at one stage. This was at a time when I wasn't married at all, but, I mean, you know, internets, you know, don't, well, logic isn't really their strong point, and I'm babbling again. Anyway, it would explain, however, why American Renaissance is so great on race, and yet Taylor allows not so much as a whisper about the Jewish question. Now remember A.K. Chesterton's motto, if they don't name the Jew, their message isn't true. Jared Taylor doesn't name the Jew. He's not anti-Semitic, and apparently the connection between this guy who fired the shots and American Renaissance is that this Loughner character visited his website. Which, I guess, that's going to become a crime or some kind of federal offense now. Who knows? When the American Renaissance thing doesn't pan out, and after Limbaugh and Glenn Beck fall all over themselves, backtracking and groveling and denying any responsibility, it's possible that the regime's secret police may decide to settle for lesser game and I'll get a visit. If only to try and rattle my cage and maybe see if they can make me walk back what I've been saying and writing for the past 10 years, if only by way of an experiment. Ain't happening, guys. Now, for the record, I have no idea who Jared Loughner is, but neither can I swear to anyone that he is not among my weekly 3,000 or so listeners to Radio Free Northwest. It's been suggested on some of the other forums that Loughner is a Jew and a lefty himself, and for all I know, that may be true. Like I've said, we're still in that confused first 48 hours of one of these incidents where nobody really knows what the hell happened, and the media are simply adding to the confusion by putting out a lot of unverified crap. Like I've said, by the time this podcast airs on Wednesday or Thursday, the whole situation here may have changed. Now, because I'm working with a serious lack of data, I'm not going to really get into this situation now. but I will state for the record that unlike the Tea Party idiots, or no doubt Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck on tomorrow morning's show, I have no intention of trying to walk back or retract anything I've ever said or written other than the simple statement of fact that I do not know this man and I am not responsible for any moral or political decisions he may or may not have made. You guys will remember that I have described such a possible scenario of events before, wherein the regime attempts to establish a connection between me and my novels in the Northwest Independence Movement and the actions of someone I've never heard of. If they can't succeed in establishing a Tea Party or Limbaugh or Beck connection, and those guys are going to be their primary targets, they may be content with a lesser target. Now, just a standard warning. Whenever this kind of thing happens, and it is going to be happening a lot in the future, everyone needs to make sure that their own premises are raid ready. Make sure that there is nothing in your house or on your property that shouldn't be there. If they are going to arrest people for opposing the regime, make the sons of bitches plant or fabricate the evidence from the get-go. Now, beyond that, I'm not going to comment on this particular incident any further at this time because the exact sequence of events is not clear. Like Sherlock Holmes once said, it's a capital mistake to theorize without data. And, of course, I would never attempt to find humor or satisfaction in the death of a woman who was an integral part of the most utterly vicious and corrupt political system in human history, or in the death of a man who was paid a large salary to send other human beings into the closest approximation to hell on earth that mankind has ever devised.
About the time my daddy left to fight the big war, I saw my first pistol in the general store, in the general store. Well, I was 13. I thought it was the finest thing I ever had seen. So I asked if I could have one Sunday when I grew up. Mama dropped a dozen eggs. She really blew up. Yes, she really blew up. She didn't understand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The very first pistol was a cap and ball coat. Shoot as fast as lightning, but it moves a mile slow. It moves a mile slow. Soon I found out it'll get you into trouble, but it can't get you out. About a year later, got a Colt 45. Called a peacemaker, but I never knew why. I never knew why. I didn't understand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol is the devil's right hand. So I shot the dog down, shot the dog down. Watched the man fall. Never touched his holster, never had a chance to call. Trial was in the morning, then they put me out of bed. Ask me how I pleaded, not guilty, I said. Not guilty, I said. You got the wrong man. Left them touch the trigger, but the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. But the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama said the pistol hit the devil's right hand.
Okay, now listen up, guys. This is serious now. What I'm going to do is something I think I actually did early last summer. I'm going to replay a commentary that I made back in February of last year when a man named Joseph Stack flew his airplane into the IRS building in Austin, Texas in a kind of kamikaze mission because he had been so badly fucked over and his life destroyed by America. I want everyone to listen very carefully to what I have to say in this short cast because in it I make crystal clear what my true attitude towards individual acts of violence is. If and when I'm ever arrested by the secret police and charged by the regime for allegedly inciting something or whatever, I will probably just play this one short podcast as my defense. So listen up, guys. This is the real deal. This is Harold Covington speaking, and the date is February the 18th, 2010. This morning, at around 10 o'clock Central Standard Time, a man named Joseph Stack crashed a light aircraft into the Internal Revenue Service offices in the Federal Building in Austin, Texas. He left behind a long online manifesto, or final communication, in which he described with great passion and somewhat less coherence the shafting that, like so many white men of his generation, he received at the hands of the America he was raised to believe in. At the present time, the authorities are only admitting to Stack himself being dead. Looks like the poor bastard didn't even manage to take a single bureaucrat in a suit with him. It's not clear at this point whether Stack had any white racial leanings or not, but his is a condition of mind and soul we can all sympathize with. To quote his own farewell address to the world, he said, "I have just had enough." In this, he speaks for all white Americans, and his willingness to make his point by giving up his own life tells us that, at least, he meant what he said. I've spoken before in my writings of what the radicals of the 19th century referred to as the propaganda of the deed. Well, this was it. Was his act a complete waste? I hope not, but I'm not sanguine about his chances of accomplishing anything. Americans mostly exist on a Beavis and Butthead level. Symbolic gestures like Stack's go right over their heads. But I want to take this opportunity to speak to all of you out there, both men of Stack's generation and mine, and also to young white kids who have been raised under political correctness and who understand that America no longer holds out any hope or any future for them. Time and again, over the past 40 years, I've seen white men snap like this. They go to a shopping mall or a former workplace armed with a couple of semi-autos and they come in the door smoking, or else just go off on a pointless spree blasting anything black or brown that moves until the cops catch up with him, and either the guy gets shot by the police or else he sticks the muzzle in his own mouth and he blows himself away. I know that right now there are untold numbers of angry white males out there who have been driven to the point of homicidal rage by the terrible injustice, the unfairness, and the tyranny of mind, body, and spirit, which is Obama's America in 2010. I know some of you in the back of your minds are contemplating doing something of this nature. You wouldn't be human if you weren't. I know some of you listening to my voice right now are thinking in your desperation and your righteous rage at the wrongs that America has done to you that going out in a blaze of glory might just be worth it. I'm telling you now, no, it isn't. There are practical reasons why it isn't worth it. Not the least being that there's no way you could possibly inflict enough damage on the enemy to justify the sacrifice of a single racially aware white life. There are so few, so terribly few of us, and every one of you is precious to me and to our racial future. If you were able to kill 100 or 1,000 street niggers or Mexicans or federal bureaucrats, the scales still wouldn't balance in our favor. I'm reminded of the words of General George Patton, who said, "Nobody ever won a war by dying for his country. You win by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country." You may reply, "It's my life and I can give it up when and how I want." No, it isn't. Your life belongs to your people and to the moment of history into which you have been born, and it is not yours to throw away. The late Pastor Robert Miles once said, "A racist is someone who knows who he is." If you have attained the precious gift of racial consciousness, of knowing who you are, then it is your inescapable duty to use that consciousness to secure the existence of our people in the future for white children. You are not in this for yourself, for your own benefit or your own private vengeance. Now, there have been ages in the past wherein white men were free to live for themselves and their own desires. this time and place we live in is not one of them. Many of you will have read my Northwest Independence novels, and I want to remind you of what I had a number of my characters say in all four of those books in one form or another. The duty of a revolutionary is not to kill people, but to free people. Our goal is to change the world, and all of our personal lives, actions, and decisions must be subordinated to that objective. Any damn fool can die for his country and his cause. Only a true patriot and a man of honor and integrity can find within himself the strength of character, the self-discipline, and the iron will to live for it. That kind of moral strength and character is what I demand of everyone associated with the Northwest Front, and it is what all of you should demand of yourselves. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.